Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And in thinking seriously, we've been tempted to create or cultivate, anyway, an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. If you're brand new to the podcast and you have no idea what those mean, in a nutshell, it just means that we're trying to be generous and kind to people, be interested in what they say and why they say it, and don't just automatically assume that we're enemies or something, because we can become friends with all sorts of people. But also, we want to be committed to the most rigorous form of argumentation possible and not just, you know, live in trope land or whatever it is. We want to make sure to sort of like do both of those things. So we talk to all sorts of people on the podcast. It's a lot of fun. All sorts of topics, all sorts of ideas, all across the spectrum, and it's a great time. Now, today, I'm thrilled to introduce you all to Dr. Abigail Favale, and I hopefully got that right. Close enough, anyway.
Yeah, close enough.
But I am thrilled to do this because her book is tremendous. We're going to be talking about her book, Genesis of Gender. I had it on my shelf for a long time. I had a bunch of friends read it and say, it's awesome. And I was like, I need to get to it. And I finally did. And I was like, this is true. It is awesome. So I'm excited just to talk about the ideas in here. It's well-written, it's articulate, and it really covers a ton of ground, an incredible amount of ground for the size of it. So I, in my mind, I'm thinking this has to be a much larger book for the amount of stuff you're able to cover. So before, I don't want to ramble anymore. I want to hear from you on the book, but I do want to hear, Abigail, a little bit about who you are, what you do, and then why did you decide to write this book?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'm Abigail Favale, and I'm now a Midwestern mom of four. and I'm also a professor at the University of Notre Dame and a writer. And my academic background is in feminist thought and women's writing. And since becoming Catholic about 10 years ago, I write about the world of feminism and gender studies from a Catholic Christian perspective, and often with an eye toward helping fellow Christians navigate these topics. And I actually started out trying to write a book on Christian feminism. And then the chapter on gender just started to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And I realized, I remember telling my editor, oh, I think this book is becoming a different book. So that's how the Genesis of Gender came to be. So there's still a lot of thoughts I have about women and feminism that didn't make it into that book. So hopefully I'll write more books in the future. But
yeah, hopefully that is the case. I would definitely look forward to those. You mentioned Christian feminism. I would be interested in just hearing what exactly that means, because you use the term in the book, and I think at one point, early on anyway, you say it means being a heretic one way or another. Mm-hmm. And depending on who I'm talking to, if they say Christian feminist, it feels like it could mean 10 different things. So
yes.
Help me understand what's going on with that term.
Yes, exactly. I think that's I agree with that. So when I say that in order to be a Christian feminist, you have to be a heretic one way or another, what I mean is that if you're taking Christianity as your foundational framework from which you engage in feminist analysis, that will lead you to some heretical places from a feminist perspective, right? You're going to kind of part ways with so-called orthodox feminist views on certain things. And if the reverse is true, if you have kind of mainstream feminism, secular feminism as your dominant framework, and then you're kind of engaging with Christianity from that perspective, then that'll lead you into some heretical positions. So another way of putting that might be, I think it's possible to be a Christian feminist, but too often the forms that Christian feminism takes is it's a fundamentally feminism and only secondarily Christian. And so I think an authentic Christian feminism would be fully Christian in its premises, and then using those premises, like working from those premises to think about issues that affect women or undermine women's dignity in society. So I think there's very much a need for that coming from a very thoroughly Christian place. But I think, unfortunately, a lot of forms that Christian feminism takes are not necessarily Christian.
Yeah, no, that's good. And maybe we can get into some of those at some point. I think I've got a question I wanted to ask later on, but I want to start. One of the things you lead with and sort of like setting up the book, it seems, is the idea that we need to know where we're from in order to know who we are. And I just wanted to make sure to spend some time sort of like allowing you to cash out what that means and how that's relevant for the overall project.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the basic idea there is that origin stories matter. And certainly in the ancient world, cosmologies are not fundamentally about giving an account of material origins, right? That's kind of a modern preoccupation. So if we go to Genesis expecting a kind of scientific account of how the universe came to be, we're going to totally misread the text. So the text is much more interested in questions, in raising the question of origin in order to give an account of who we are and what we're made for. So to give an account of our origin in order to understand our nature and our purpose. And it's true, even in feminist thought, there's, you know, feminists will have their own origin stories. And those matter and come into play in terms of how they diagnose the problem and what they see as a possible solution. So coming from a Christian understanding, then Genesis really matters. So it's not just, again, this kind of historical or mythical kind of account of where we originated, but it still holds truths about, fundamental truths about our nature as human beings, who we've been created to be, what has gone wrong, and how it can be fixed.
So one other thing that you tied into Genesis that was really helpful, in my view, was when you were trying to explain the constructionist view of language and how it seems to be an inversion of the correspondence view in Genesis. I'd love to understand just like, what is that always the case? Why is that the case? And how should we think about language given what we know from in Genesis?
Yeah. So what I'm talking about there is the wonderful moment in Genesis 2 where it's the parade of animals, right? So the first human has been made and God has said, it's not good for this human to be alone. I will make a counterpart for him, right? And so God begins crafting these different animals and then bringing them to the human who then looks at them and names them, right? And we don't hear what names he's giving them at this point. But later when we see the same thing happen with woman, when God has finally made woman out of man's side and brought her to, kind of presented her to the man. And at that point, we actually hear the process of naming, right? So he sees her and he says, at last, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, she will be called woman, or in the Hebrew, it's Isha, and Ish is the man. So in that naming, he's naming her nature in relation to him and also naming himself in relation to her, because it's the first instance of the Ish and the Isha in the text is in that naming. And so when we see that moment, it becomes clear that he's choosing a name that corresponds with her nature. So the names he's been giving to the beings that God is presenting to him are not just arbitrary kind of constructs. Rather, he's expressing linguistically what God has made, right? And trying to use language in a way that corresponds to what God has created. And so I contrast that with the constructionist view of language that is predominant in contemporary gender theory and kind of postmodern theory, which would say that language isn't primarily a response to reality, but actually our understanding of reality is primarily a construct of language. So the words we use actually create or shape what's real. And I think, you know, so there is a seed of truth to that. That's the thing. Mm-hmm. I think that language has a profound power to shape our perception of reality. But the different position I would land on is that reality still exists, right? So our words are true insofar as they correspond to what's real, even though we can misuse language in a way that distorts what's real, right? But the constructivist view, at least an extreme constructivist view, would say that there is no reality to correspond with because what is real is a product of language.
Yeah, that's helpful. So when I think about a concrete example, it seems like what's widespread is, you know, in people's email signatures now, you got to have your pronouns and you're choosing your pronouns based upon, I guess, your perceived identity. Is that a constructivist view, or is it somewhere along the range where it seems like they want to say their pronouns are based on something, but they're making it based on just whatever's in their mind, I assume, rather than a biological category.
Right. Yeah. So we've seen a shift in our time with the kind of debates about pronouns, where what used to be named in a pronoun in terms of human beings is a concrete objective reality. And now there's been a shift to claiming that gender is an internal and subjective reality. So it's actually not rooted in anything concrete. It's not rooted in anything except the kind of subjective experience. And because it's not rooted in the concrete, the power of language becomes essential in redirecting away from concrete reality to the subjective, right? So it requires the linguistic participation of other people. So I think in these debates about gender, the revising of certain words and terms, and there are other examples too, right? Like not referring to mothers, but pregnant people, right? There's a concerted attempt here to change the way we speak in order to change the way we think, in order to support a purely subjectivist understanding of gender. And so that would be an example of an actively constructivist use of language, right? To kind of reconstruct our understanding of what it means to even be a woman or to be a man.
Now, do you think those who want to promote more of a constructivist view on these things are doing damage to other people? So I guess one of my more practical questions is, let's say you're in a work culture that requires you to put your pronouns there. Are you actively hurting people by putting your pronouns there? Should you say, no, I don't want to do that, participate in that? That's you know, misrepresenting what objective reality is, or how do people think about these situations that they're faced with on a regular basis? I mean, I remember the first time I was faced with this question, I was taking a course at the University of Louisville, and like one of the first questions was like, everybody, you know, state your name, state your, you know, what your preferred pronouns. And I was like, this is not what I'm used to. I guess I just say that I'm a he, him, but like, should I like object to even that question? What should the approach be there to best, I mean, promote a healthy view of reality for people?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think the vast majority of people who put pronouns in their bio aren't like, I am a constructivist, you know, and I am going to use this, you know, they're wanting to do the nice thing, you know, right. Maybe this is the compassionate thing to do, or maybe like, oh, this is what everyone's doing now, whatever, that's fine, it doesn't matter, right? So most people are just, I think, trying to conform for good reasons on this. Now, when it comes to what one should do, I'm not going to sit here and make these like moral pronouncements, and I don't want to bind a person's conscience to, I think this has to be discerned. I will say, when it comes to the question of pronouns, I find there's a very big difference between signaling a conformity to an ideology and using pronouns as for a very specific relational reason, right? So in terms of the kind of workplace culture, pronouns in the email, state your pronouns, you know, in this kind of artificial professional setting, in those situations, I'm much more inclined to just not comply, because I'm too aware of the assumptions behind everything. I'm too aware that to kind of play along is to endorse a certain perspective about gender that I simply do not agree with, that I don't think is true. Now, I think this is a separate question from like, okay, if my, you know, adult brother comes out as trans, how should I refer to him from, you know, that's a more complicated question. So I do want to disentangle these things, because I think in that other instance, there is a real relational good that matters, that is kind of absent in the first one, where it really is a kind of artificial, there probably isn't even a trans person around, you know, it's just a bunch of kind of people in a room, and this is now the box you're supposed to tick. So in those situations, I would probably either just not say anything, you know, or I would say something like, I'm a woman, you know, but it is technically true that if I say she, her, that is a correspondence view, right? That's why I say I'm a she, not because I feel a particular way, but just because that is the kind of body that I am. But I think that I don't put that in my email for a reason. And that's because I think it endorses an ideology that I don't endorse.
Yeah, that's helpful. So thinking along that line, you mentioned this concept of the gender paradigm throughout the book. I mean, what is this gender paradigm? How does it contrast with a Christian paradigm for thinking about sex and gender or whatever term we're using?
Yeah, so I think there are some of the differences between what I call the gender paradigm and the Genesis paradigm. One would be a different understanding of who's the creator. Okay, mm-hmm. So in the Genesis paradigm, obviously there is a creator. There's an uncreated creator who gives us our being. We receive reality as a gift. We receive our own nature as a gift from that creator who has lovingly and meaningfully designed us. But in the gender paradigm, in the kind of more postmodern understanding of gender, we are the ones who do the creating. Human beings are the ones who do the creating. So in the kind of constructivist view of gender, gender is a social construct, and so it's something we actively create as human beings. And in the more kind of subjective view of gender, my gender is something I feel, and then I enact in the world through technology or through certain behavior and expression. So we don't. There's not an understanding in the gender paradigm of our creatureliness, right? We're not. Our identity is not seen as something we receive, but it's something that we have to create for ourselves. So that's one big distinction. We've talked about the linguistic distinction. So I think there are very different understandings of language that operate here that are related to different understandings of reality, which I discussed earlier. And I think one of the major differences, like in the Genesis paradigm, sexual difference is real. It's not just a construct. It's real and it's good. And it's part of God's self-disclosure through creation to us. So it has a sacramental meaning. It has a sacred meaning, as well as a very important temporal meaning for our life on earth. And in the gender paradigm, sexual difference is a construct, right? It doesn't fundamentally matter. And the body it does not have sacramental meaning. The body does not necessarily reveal the person, but the body is more a kind of avatar of the self that has to be carefully curated rather than a gift that we receive from God.
Yeah, that's really helpful. So I don't want to ask you to canvas the entire history of feminism because we don't have time for that. And plus, I want to tell people just go buy the book and read it. But I found that section where you were describing each of the waves and some of the history that and the genealogical connections to different areas very helpful. And I would be interested in knowing, at least from your perspective, what's potentially the most important aspect of the history of feminism for particularly Christians to know about and to understand.
Yeah, and I could do like a real quick overview too. Yeah. So in a nutshell, first wave feminism, so late 19th century, early 20th, very much concerned about legal inequalities between men and women, primarily the right to vote, but also things like the right to own and inherit property, custodial rights over children, being able to serve on juries, those sorts of things. So there was not yet in feminist thought at that time a desire for total social or sexual revolution. First wave feminists were by and large against the contraception movement. They were against abortion. And they didn't want to kind of overthrow the system, right? They just wanted women to have legal representation within the system. And most of them were Christians. Most of them were Protestant Christian women. And in the second wave, there was like a kind of a lull between the first and the second wave. The concern really became much more on women's access to the professional world. And also, it was in the second wave, and this is something that I think is really important from a Christian perspective. It's in the second wave that the goals of the sexual revolution and the feminist movement become allied. They really become entwined. So it's here that feminism takes the right to abortion, the rights to contraception, sexual freedom, and as fundamental and intrinsic to feminism, which is a major departure from first wave feminists. So I think sometimes that is a misunderstanding that feminism has always had those perspectives, but it really is a shift that happens in the second wave. And then the third wave, there are these interesting debates among feminists about whether things like prostitution and pornography are liberating for women or not. So there was a deep divide among feminists at that time in the 80s. And then the so-called sex positive feminists won that war. And that became kind of the third wave of feminism. And so again, in that movement, the kind of values of the sexual revolution become even more deeply entrenched in feminism. So I would say that is a major kind of thing to think about, because I'm very much a critic of sexual revolution. At the same time, I think I don't want to throw feminism out, like the baby out with the bathwater. I do think it's possible to cultivate a feminism that has not completely absorbed those values.
That's interesting. So I imagine a good chunk of our listeners probably hear the terminology just of feminism, and the alarm bells go off and say, like, I don't like the term. If you want to like get rid of the bathwater and keep the baby, let's change the term and use it for something else. Do you feel like there's a sense in which maybe it can be confusing to call something feminism that's good?
Yeah, I think feminism has a brand problem for sure. And I have an ambivalence with the term. I get frustrated with it because, again, I think it has taken on a meaning that is so entrenched with certain values that I can't endorse. But at the same time, I also think, as a consequence of the fall, the relationship between the sexes has been very distorted. It is prone to conflicts, like dynamics of conflicts and domination that are often at the cost of women. And so it's important to be attentive to those. And I'm concerned in some circles to see like a backlash against feminism that's so pronounced that it almost wants to kind of go back to this kind of idealized vision of the past where, you know, maybe women shouldn't have the right to vote, or maybe women shouldn't be educated, you know? And I think that seems like not the direction we want to go in. So it is tricky. And I do think feminism as a term is flawed in the sense that it has connotations of female supremacy, which as a, coming from a Christian feminist perspective, the goal would be to kind of restore more of a dynamic of harmony and collaboration between the sexes. So it's not about female supremacy. But the goods and flourishing of men and the good and flourishing of women are interdependent and intertwined. So I'm more interested in a kind of like solidarity between the sexes rather than opposition. And I think feminism has too often, unfortunately, especially since the second wave, fed into opposition between the sexes. So I totally get it. So I'm not going to sit here and like fall on my sword that I want everyone to identify as a feminist because, but I also don't want people to be overly dismissive of feminism or to become anti-feminist just because, they find feminism annoying or something.
Yeah, no, that's good. I like if I go on the internet right now, it would not take me very long to find somebody advocating to repeal. Is it the 19th Amendment?
It's become this sort of like popular. I don't know. Maybe I should take it more seriously. But honestly, when I hear someone say that, I feel like it's just someone wanting to show how based they are.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just like I'm so based. I think women should. You know, I have yet to find like a serious, compelling case for that. But I don't know. Maybe I'm being a little too naive.
I think it's influential with a large segment of very online young men and older men who feel like they need to find some sort of outlet to prove how masculine they are. But that's not our topic here. So a couple of other things that before I move on, just the concept of role. I mean, we probably have 75, 80% of our listeners are Protestant-ish. And I feel like a lot of Protestants are very at least over the last 50 years, are very interested in the roles discussion. What role does a man and a woman have? Do they have distinct roles that should never be interchanged? Like, is it okay ever for a father to be a stay-at-home dad? Is that violating something in the law of nature or something like that? So are there any resources or tools to think about like how roles should actually play out in real life?
Yeah, this is, I mean, I grew up Protestant. So when I first started being interested in these questions, it was almost entirely centered on the question of roles. And so one of the things that was interesting about becoming Catholic is how that's less the case. So it seems like in kind of a Catholic perspective, the focus is more on being rather than doing. It's more, I mean, that's what my interest is. Like,
yeah.
Let's develop a robust theology about who a woman is and who a man is in our kind of being. And the roles question, I think kind of signals maybe a preoccupation of doing over being. And so my view is that, you know, what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman, I mean, the very differentiation arises from bodily differences. And bodily differences are most pronounced, most obvious, and most different when it comes to our respective roles in procreation. That's where the differences are most pronounced, right? When it comes to things like psychological differences or brain differences or personality differences, when we're talking about those sorts of differences, we're very much in the realm of like a bimodal spectrum, right? So like a spectrum that has kind of two humps that overlap, right? Yeah. So we can talk about averages. But anyway, all that to say, there's a lot of overlap in those kinds of differences. Now, where the difference is most pronounced and most meaningful is when it comes to reproduction, because there's real asymmetry there in terms of the role that a woman carries, literally carries, you know, in having a child and in feeding a child after birth. And so the closer we get to those realities, that's where I think we need to be realistic about the reality of our bodies when we think about you know, what a woman does or what a man does. For example, I think the cultural norm in America for, you know, a woman who had a baby 6 weeks ago to return to work is inhuman. Like, I think it's terrible. And I see it happen with my colleagues, you know, and I feel like my heart just like, no woman who had just had a baby wants to go back to work full time after 6 weeks. Like, I don't care who you are. You don't want to do it. You're still bleeding. Like, you know, you're bleeding, you're lactating, like you just, you know, and so I think that very much disregards the reality of women's bodies in a way that I think is devaluing to women, actually. Now, when we get further away from the reproductive realities, that's where I think roles perhaps need to be something that's more discerned based on, if we're talking about a married couple, a particular married couple's circumstances and their kind of unique traits and gifts. So I don't think it's helpful to say in an absolute sense that the woman is the one who should be at home raising the children, the man is the one who should be outside working. We think of that as like a traditional model, but it's actually a modern model. It's a post-industrial revolution model. The traditional model would actually be both male and female work happening in the kind of the homestead, but yeah, having sort of different ways that they contribute to that domestic sphere. And I think it's just, it's hard to make absolutes in the abstract when so much about the question of who works and who doesn't has to do with what economic opportunities are available, who's healthy, you know, who's in a viable job market, you know, and I just think couples need to be free to discern that, you know, again, with the caveat that, you know, there are very real bodily realities in pregnancy and probably the first 6 months of life, especially, but really the first year of life, where, you know, I really do wish we had a culture that promoted women prioritizing motherhood in that time, and not jeopardizing their, you know, professional life for, you know, most of the world has generous maternity leave. We're really an outlier And I think that's a problem.
Yeah, no, that's good. So one of the chapters that was really helpful to me that I hadn't really thought through, and I was surprised by a lot of the data that you put together, was the history of contraception and how it's led to where we are currently. So I'd love just to hear a little bit of the story of how that's functioning in the current narrative as we think about terminology of things like reproductive rights or abortion. And because, you know, I hear the statistics marshaled all the time of, you know, you outlaw abortion and abortions go up. And so it seems like, okay, like what's causing this here? And your explanation of contraception made a whole lot of sense to me. So unless somebody else can convince me otherwise, like what you've described here is so helpful. And I keep wanting to tell people, no, you got to read this to understand why this is happening.
Yeah. Okay, good. I'm always, when I start talking about contraception, I'm like, I always feel like I'm putting my like Catholic conspiracy hat on, you know, like here's my tinfoil hat as the Catholic. Anyway. A lot of what I trace in the book is kind of a conceptual revolution that happens in shifting understandings of gender in the 20th century. But that happens alongside a technological revolution, which is primarily driven by contraception, right? So I talk about the contraception movement, which, as I mentioned earlier, was not actually part of the first wave feminism. That wasn't a dominant view in first wave. And, you know, Margaret Sanger was the primary person who really spearheaded that movement and then kind of funded and helped develop the birth control pill. And one of the arguments I make is that becoming a contraceptive culture fundamentally changed our implicit understanding of what it even means to be a man and to be a woman. Because prior to that, the procreative differences were very much at the forefront, right? When we thought like a man has the potential to be a father, a woman has the potential to be a mother, that was just very much in our kind of immediate awareness. And I think with contraception and kind of becoming a contraceptive culture, we now, again, think about the sexes not primarily in terms of their procreative difference, but things like roles or things like behaviors or even what we look like, right? So contraception, I think, is an important part of the gradual shift toward the idea that anyone who identifies as a woman is a woman, right? Because we've kind of severed that link between sex and procreation, right? It's like a switch that we can kind of opt into. It's something we can opt into or opt out of. And another thing that I discovered in doing the research for this book, which I thought was interesting, is that the same technology that was used to develop the birth control pill in the 50s was, it was the same technology that they were using to first experiment with cross-sex hormone use in trying to feminize masculine bodies. So it's the same technology, right? It's this manipulation of hormones. And there's a thinker who I respect named Mary Harrington. She's a writer. And she argues that the pill is the first transhumanist technology because its entire purpose is to cause a female body to malfunction, right? So unlike most medical interventions where you want to optimize the health and normal functioning of the body, the whole purpose of the birth control pill is to kind of mess up a woman's reproductive system so it doesn't work right. And so she calls it the first transhumanist technology because the whole purpose is to alter our nature, right? And I also make the argument that this has an underlying masculine bias because it basically says that the reason or the way to solve the quote unquote problem of female fertility is to make a woman's body function as much as possible like a man's, right? So with the use of contraception as well, we kind of adapted our culture and our sexual norms to the standard of male sexuality, the norm of male sexuality. And you can see that too, even in just sexual practice, right? Like the kind of assumption now is that we should adopt sexual practices like we're the kinds of beings that can have sex as much as we want and never get pregnant. Well, that's the male norm, right? So that's kind of part of how I think the influence of contraception is really significant here in ways that we don't understand. And I also, you know, you brought up kind of abortion rates and things. And so one of the interesting things is that once when a society first becomes contraceptive, the abortion rates skyrocket. And that's counterintuitive, right? Because the common thinking would be that no, abortion actually keeps contraception keeps abortion rates down. Now, when it is true that once a society is a contraceptive society, and that is the norm, and so sexual practices and norms have already been adapted to that model, then I do think there's something to be said about that argument of contraception being potentially keeping abortion rates stable, right? But it is really, like, if you actually look at the data of the abortion rate prior to the pill becoming legal and afterward, I mean, we go from like hundreds to millions, you know, in like a decade. It's really shocking. And another, just one more thing I'll point out in the contraception, like, so another piece of this puzzle is that even though we are a contraceptive culture, the unplanned pregnancy rate is still quite high, even up to like 50% or higher. So most pregnancies that occur in the United States are not planned, so to speak. And that, again, is counterintuitive, right? Because contraception is incredibly available. People know about it, right? We're expected to be on it as women. And so one of the things that, one of the explanations I propose is that because the use of contraception changes one's mindset about sexuality, and it distances us from the reality of our fertility so that we implicitly begin to think of ourselves as sterile beings. And then that actually leads to kind of failure rates in contraception, like one, riskier sexual behavior, but also maybe just even forgetting to take the pill altogether because you forget that you need it because you don't think of yourself as fertile, right? And that, so I call that the contraceptive paradox, right? So I really do think that this vision of contraception is this kind of panacea for women's problems, and like the linchpin for women's freedom is a very simplistic narrative that is not actually in line with the facts on the ground. So anyway, yeah. That's my little contraception conspiracy spiel.
I think it's great. So it was very convincing to me anyway. And I remember when I was reading that chapter, I was talking to my wife all about it. And so we had a good time discussing it. Now, I also want to know a little bit about, just, is there a distinction between the term sex and gender? That seems to be, you know, pretty much social dogma that gender is sort of the performative role-based approach that's not biological, whereas sex is just your biology. But even that now, I guess there's people who say sex is a fiction too. But let's just assume that it's a biological category. Is it helpful in any sense to say there's a distinction between these two terms, or should we just say, nope, they mean the same thing?
Yeah. So, I mean, originally the distinction arose exactly like you described, like the first kind of in feminist thought, the sex gender distinction was a way to name the kind of cultural influences the kind of cultural aspects of what it means to be a woman or what it means to be a man. So things that aren't strictly natural, but that are kind of layered onto that reality. So like, you know, an easy example is like women having longer hair. You know, it's not as if my hair grows longer. You know, my hair does not grow differently than a man's hair. So that's a kind of a cultural norm, right? So in that original meaning, gender was cultural, sex is biological. But we're now in this weird moment where gender, I think primarily, so that, I would say that's the constructivist view of gender. Gender is a social construct. Mm-hmm. But now we also have this view of gender that gender is a subjective sense of self, this kind of gender identity, right? So I am a woman if I feel deeply that I am a woman. Now that's a very different understanding of gender. That is something, one, on the one view, gender is a social construct. Gender is external. It is social. And it's often oppressive. It's seen negatively. In the kind of new understanding of gender, gender is internal. It's intrinsic. It's not social. It's not socially constructed. It's like who I really am. And it's something positive, right? So it's actually a very different understanding of gender. And what's confusing is that we have both of these understanding of gender like in the air right now. So people kind of veer from like, well, gender is just a social construct, to gender is an innate sense of self. So there's constant equivocation about what the term even means. But what both of those theories agree upon is that sex is the construct, right? That like sex or sexual difference doesn't matter. that it's the sexed body does not determine our gender. And so I think that's the real root of the problem. So I am no longer a fan of the sex gender distinction because I think it introduces, like it's a helpful distinction to make between cultural and biological. That's helpful. But to have a terminology where what it does is it separates woman, which is kind of associated with gender, and female, which is associated with biology, right? So it kind of drives a wedge between woman and female, which in our time has just become a complete separation. So I think in our time, it's important to use language in a way that integrates woman and female, right? So if I use the term gender, I am either defining it super clearly, like what am I talking about? Or, you know, I think maybe there is some value to using gender and sex interchangeably as a way to reintegrate what has been like completely separated in an unhelpful way. So I think we should use the term gender very, we should be very cautious about how we use it because I think it's doing a lot of damage right now.
Yeah, no, that's good. The last thing I want to ask you related to the book is your work on intersex people. That seems to be a common objection just to more of a traditional Christian framework when thinking about these things as well. Look, there's, you've got all these people who don't fit in this binary category. And I think you were very helpful in sort of explaining what exactly intersex is and the fact that a lot of the explanations that statistics are misunderstanding what it is. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's probably the most important chapter of my book, to be honest, because I think there's so much misunderstanding about intersex conditions in a way that causes a lot of confusion in this topic. And what it almost usually serves to do is to kind of knock the sort of average person off balance and get them to begin to question what they know about what is obvious, right? Which is that the human species comes in two sexes. So yeah, I actually started studying intersex conditions back in graduate school, like 20 years ago or 15 years ago, before you know, the trans phenomenon was really a kind of cultural phenomenon that it is now. So I've been thinking about it for a long time, right? But here are some of the kind of common misunderstandings about intersex conditions. One, intersex conditions are talked about as if they're exemptions from the binary, as if an intersex person is neither male nor female. But intersex conditions, what actually refer to, it's a canopy term, it refers to a range of different conditions that somehow affect the development of the sexual reproductive system. So the vast majority of intersex conditions, which are typically called DSDs or disorders of sexual development, the vast majority of them do not result in any kind of sexual ambiguity at all, right? So the baby would still be, you know, the sex would be correctly observed at birth, even if later in the development process, there's something that goes awry. So that's one thing I would clarify, that intersex does not mean sexually ambiguous. So that we should think about disorders of sexual development as variations within the categories of male and female rather than exemptions from them. Many DSDs are sex specific. So, you know, only males can get Klinefelter syndrome, for example, or only females can have vaginal agenesis, right? So it would be, I think it's actually dehumanizing to, you know, look at a man with Klinefelter syndrome and say, well, you're not really a man, right? Just as there are kind of physical abnormalities that can develop in any of the systems that we have in our body, it's also true of the reproductive system. It does not mean that there is a third sex. There's no third sex. There's no third gamete. There's no kind of third option in the reproductive process. So I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. Also, the rates of intersex conditions are highly exaggerated. There's a very common statistic out there that 1.7% of people are intersexed. And that statistic comes from the work of a biologist named Anne Fausto Sterling, who I studied in graduate school, who's very much adopted kind of postmodern gender theory. And she gets to that statistic by defining as intersex anyone who does not meet the, quote, platonic ideal. I'm like, so it encompasses like a wide range, like it's a huge range, again, the vast majority of which would not create sexual ambiguity at all. So the rare DSDs, the rare congenital DSDs that do result in ambiguity at birth are much rarer. Those occur only in 0.0182% of live births. So to flip the statistic, that means in 99.982% of all births, maleness and femaleness is correctly observed and unambiguous. And that to me is actually surprising, considering how complicated the sexual development process is and how many things could possibly, you know, go awry. It's actually remarkably stable. It's remarkable to me how stable the sex binary is. So I think we really need to stop using people with DSDs as a kind of political football in this debate about gender, because that's how it's used. The intersex card is played in order to kind of dethrone the reality of sexual difference. So then some kind of theory of gender can be used to replace the categories of sex.
Awesome. Well, this has been great. So I want to tell everybody who's listening, go get a copy of the book. Go buy a box of the books if you need to and share them with the people at your church. There's probably not many of you who are listening who are afraid of Catholics, but if you are, like, it's okay. This is a great
book.
We get it.
We're nice people. We love Jesus too.
Yeah, if you've been listening to me at least long enough, you know that we overlap in pretty much everything except for some issues with soteriology and stuff. So anthropology, mm-hmm. I mean,
yes, that's true. Yeah.
Go read Thomas Aquinas. It'll be good for your soul. Mm-hmm. Now, Abigail, I imagine we want more research and thinking on this topic. Are you teaching students right now? Do you supervise graduate students in any way?
So I am teaching students. I do directed readings with students sometimes. I'm not currently they're supervising doctoral dissertations or anything like that. But I wonder if they would let me do that. Actually, that's interesting. The problem is, like, I'm appointed in an institute rather than a department. So my faculty position is a little bit different than the standard faculty role. So I am teaching undergrads, however, and right now I'm teaching a course called Catholicism and the Sexes, which has been really fun because we kind of go through the history of ideas and theology and engage with, you know, feminist thought and contemporary gender theory from a Christian perspective. So that's what I'm currently teaching and really enjoying it.
Well, the only downside of Notre Dame is it's very cold during the winters.
It's true.
So if you can survive that, then it seems like a great place to be.
Yeah.
So Abigail, thanks for this. I'll make sure whenever these new books that you're writing and all this extra information comes out, that I try to remember to come back and add those links to the show notes. But in the meantime, the link to this book that we've been discussing is available to you there. Click it, you'll get a copy of it, get two copies of it to share it with a friend, read it with a coworker or somebody else. It's really good and it's manageable. So, you know, half the time on these podcasts, you all know, we talk to people about very expensive books that are very dense.
Yes.
This one is dense in some ways, but it's very accessible in the way it's written. So thank you for your service and what you've done here. This is really a tremendous resource. So I want to recommend everybody make sure to get a copy of it. Now, as you know, if you've been listening, this is the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you all soon.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.